And this morning we have an information meeting.
Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chairs. Today, we thought you'd be probably tired of seeing your staff do orientation, so we've asked some outside speakers to come in and talk about some major general issues with you. Today, we have Richard Sims, who is here. He is head of the Sierra Institute on Applied Economics. Richard has worked for a number of states. He was policy director for the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, affectionately known as ITEP, in Washington, D.C., and Richard's had a chance to look at state policy across the country and is going to discuss state taxation and how it influences economic activity. So Richard will be here. Oregon Education Association has arranged for Richard to come and speak with you. Following Richard, we also have Phil Sims from University of Oregon will be here to talk further about the same topic.
So now Phil Sims is the great quarterback for the New York Giants, and then it is. This would be amazing if we have Phil Sims, the former quarterback for the Giants, that's going to come and talk to us. You really have your work cut out for you, Doc. Dr. Sims, if that's your. So it's Philip Romero. Is the economist from the University of Oregon who will give us perhaps maybe a little different take on the question of business taxes and how relevant they are or not relevant. So to lead us off, Mr. Chair, is Richard Sims from, I want to say, Kentucky.
You're right.
That's gracing our state of Oregon. To talk to us about the issue of business taxation and how important it is to economic growth.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I did start my both personal and professional life in Kentucky and was on the legislative staff there for way too many years. What I'd like to share with you this morning is sort of a synopsis of some of the work that I've been doing over the last few years looking at or in addressing the question that I frequently get from governors and legislators on how do we grow our economy. One of the first things that most new governors tend to ask of their staff is, how do I create jobs and income in my state? And one of the first issues they tend to focus on has tended to be on business taxation. Should we have a more favorable business tax climate? What is a good business tax climate? What does business and individuals that are thinking of moving into our area or relocating or expanding, what really makes a difference to them? And I've looked at a few things that seem to relate to that I'd like to share with you. As we go along, I'd be glad to, if you want to interject at any time, I'm sure you'll feel free to. Otherwise, I'll just continue through this to give you a general overview of my findings, and I'll take general questions at the end, if that's okay.
So, Dr. Sims, just on that, are you okay with us asking questions as you go, or would you prefer?
Yes. As we go along, probably if we hit a good point to answer a question, that will be fine by me, and okay. I'll try to get my watch out.
We know when we ask questions, it's on our time and not yours.
Okay, great. Feel free to interrupt. First one that you might be familiar with this chart, that this is one that we did when I was with the ITAP in D.C., looking at all the 50 states at how their tax burden is distributed among the various groups of taxpayers. And as you see, in general, in Oregon, it's most income groups pay within the 8-9% range in total taxes. This includes excise taxes, the gross receipts taxes, property taxes, all forms of taxes. A qualifier on this, I was trying to figure out how to show this, so I've shown it in the shaded area in the background that goes down a little steeper. That's what you pay after federal deduction. For everyone who itemizes, you get to take certain state taxes off of your federal taxes, so it reduces the burden. So what you actually end up paying if you're at the upper income category, for example, is somewhat less, roughly 20-25% less than the nominal amount you pay, because you get to pass part of it on to the federal government as sort of a form of revenue sharing. When we look at the changes that Oregon has made over the last decade, most of the changes made in your tax system tended to shift the burden downwards a little bit. Anytime you, for example, increase the sin taxes, in general, poor people tend to sin more than rich people. When they smoke a cigarette or a pack of cigarettes, it costs a fairly substantial part of their income, as opposed to when a CEO smokes a cigarette, a CEO would have to smoke a lot of cigarettes in order to pay as much as 2% of their income in cigarette taxes. A minimum wage worker, on the other hand, smoking a pack a day would pay about 2% of their income in cigarette taxes. So when you've increased these broadly defined excise taxes, it tend to be cigarette alcohol taxes, gaming taxes, all tend to shift the relative burden in a downward direction. I was asked to look at some of the business type taxes that might relate to growth, and how do business taxes in generally affect growth. I started out by looking at corporate income tax rates and looked at the 10 states with the fastest growing per capita personal income, looked at their corporate tax rates, and saw that the average corporate tax rate of the 10 fastest growing states in the nation was about just over 7%. The 10 slowest growing states, the rate was just over 6%. So going back a slide again, the fastest growing states actually had corporate tax rates higher than the slowest growing states. Now, this is not a proof of anything, it's just a general indication that, in fact, looking at the top 10 and bottom 10 states for growth, the ones that grew the fastest incidentally had relatively high corporate tax rates.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Dr. Sims, is that growing in terms of population, growing in terms of the economy, growing in terms of new corporate businesses in those states?
Growth in per capita personal income.
Per capita personal income.
So that takes into account a couple of the variables that Representative Butler referred to.
Yes, I use that particular criteria because you can have a growth in population that's not attributable to a strong economy. It could be from in-migration for non-economic reasons. You can have an increase in employment when, if you have a major well-paying employer shut down, now you might have an increase in employment in the state because people who were working off of one income in a family now have to have two people working. Their income would have gone down, but the number of people working would have gone up. So the more or less standard measure for well-being of the population is how much each individual individually has to spend or how much they earn. So that's the reason for using the per capita personal income criteria. I incidentally looked at the corporate tax rate as a percent of corporate profits over the previous roughly two decades, and there's been a very steady downward trend in, and this is state corporate taxes. The amount they paid has fallen by roughly half, which is in part due to changes in federal legislation. When the feds change the definition of what's allowable on corporate tax returns, that filters down to the states. So about 10 to 15% of the decline is change in federal legislation. Something around 40% of the decline is change in state policies that have given corporations additional benefits that they didn't have in those earlier years. And part of it's simply what the accountants call aggressive tax planning, where states have become better at passive investment activity, where if you have a chain store that has a name that's widely recognized, the chances are you have that name chartered in a company or in a mailbox, actually, in Delaware, so that each year you send them a payment for the value of the name of your company. It becomes a deduction against Oregon taxes. It would be a liability in Delaware, except Delaware doesn't tax them. So it's a way of reducing taxes. It's perfectly legal. But the effect is that for states that have a corporate income tax, it reduces the base that they have. So that's part of the explanation for the decline in corporate taxes. While over that same period, there was about a 28% increase in average individual income tax payments around the country. I looked a little further looking at there's a group called the Tax Foundation in D.C. that you probably receive information from that looks at all the 50 states, and they rank them according to their business tax-friendly climate in their terms. I use the states that they rank most favorably, such as South Dakota, Florida, Alaska, Texas, and on down, and I looked at their performance in terms of, again, creating per capita personal income over the last decade. The average growth rate in personal income in the 10 most friendly states was 4.2%. The growth in the 10 least business tax friendly states was 4.2%. So there was no distinction between the states that were business tax friendly and the non-business tax friendly states.
Are you suggesting the correlation is close to zero?
Essentially zero.
Thank you.
Except it's a little less than zero. Mm. For example, your economic development people in Oregon get a publication called Site Selection Magazine each year. And this is sort of the Bible of economic development relocation decision makers. They rank the states according to both taxes, and they also include things such as state regulatory environment. They presume that fewer regulations are better than more regulations, that if you have a right to work, that's a plus in their criteria. So they rank all the states according to a multitude of business criteria that relocation people use. Once again, I ranked the top 25 states, North Carolina, Texas, Ohio, Georgia, and on down, in terms of their business climate. The way to read this is that the top state, North Carolina, is the most favored state in the nation in terms of business climate. Next to that, then, is North Carolina's actual performance over the last decade in terms of creating per capita personal income. And it was 39th in the country. It had the most favorable business climate, but 39th in terms of performance. Texas was second most favorable, 12th in performance. Ohio was third at 47, Georgia fourth at 43rd, Indiana should have been fifth at 46. The states at the top of the chart that are the most favored in general have very low actual performance. In fact, on average, all those 25 states that have the most favorable business climate, only 7 of them grew as fast as the national average. They were growing slower than the U.S. grows. So the sort of the conclusion that the economic development people get from this is that if you're rated as having a very favorable business climate, you're in trouble. you get the reverse results from what you would expect just looking at these criteria.
Well, Dr. Sims, doesn't that suggest that Site picked the wrong criteria?
It does.
Yes.
It suggests that chart plus the previous chart suggest that the factors such as taxation are, while they're important, they're obviously not complete in explaining growth. And as your question leads to, what's the explanation for this? One reason that taxes don't seem to matter much is that they don't vary a lot state to state. This shows graphically, top to bottom, the state's corporate income tax rates. You are just below the midpoint of the U.S. You're about 1% below the midpoint. Now, note that this 6.6 is before consideration of the corporate kicker. Your corporate kicker this year would put you just below the lowest state in terms of corporate income tax. So you would fall off the chart on the bottom end this year in terms of your effective corporate income tax rate.
So Dr. Sims,
yes.
Just one other question before we get too far ahead. So just on the site selection and I guess marching forward in the last two slides, is that an over time perspective or is that a 1 year snapshot? My guess would be if it's a 1 year snapshot, it could lead us to different conclusion than if you looked at over a 5 year or a 10 year.
In this particular case, what I'm indicating is the latest ranking against an over time trend because on any 1 year, of course, it would be meaningless for 1 year. They don't have sufficient data for me to be able to go back 10 years and look at the ranking. But North Carolina and Texas have been at the top of the list for as many years as they've been doing their survey. So it takes a while for a state to change rankings according to the criteria they use. You don't jump from the bottom end to the top end over a year-to-year basis. So you'll get different results looking at different years, but the general outcome looks the same. I've looked at this both for the...
So there is a persistency.
Right. I have this same information for 85, for 05, 04, and 03. Uh-huh. And it's while the particular states will move a couple of places one way or the other, it doesn't change the overall outcome that the top-ranked states, whether it's the top half or the top 10 or any way you slice that, tends to perform lower than, in terms of job creation or income creation, than the lower ranked states. So you get that same pattern each year. So the particular numbers aren't sacred, but the general outcome is consistent over at least the 4 years that I've got data on that.
Thank you. Senator.
Thank you. Dr. Sims,
sure.
Just real briefly. Is your data suggesting, or are you suggesting that if a state were to raise its corporate income taxes, that personal income growth in the state would increase? Is that the point?
No. It's what I'm suggesting from this is that the data says that there's no real connection between corporate taxes and economic growth in either direction. That if you when you see high-taxing states that have high growth, I don't think any economist would say that raising taxes in itself causes that growth. It just says that something else is going on that is overriding the effect of the high taxes. If everything was the same, if your spending stayed the same and your state policies all stayed the same, if you had lower taxes, you'd have more growth. But what seems to happen in looking at the data is when you have lower taxes, you have lower public services of some sort that businesses also value. Conversely, when you have high taxes, you tend to have higher something else that you spend for that they value. And that, in effect, makes it more or less washes out the effect of taxes. And in some cases, the higher taxes might for one particular state, higher taxes might cause it to lose some jobs and income growth, depending on what they do with the money.
Just a follow-up. Another thought that I had as you were speaking there, though, is there any correlation between the amount of property or land within a state that's owned publicly as opposed to does that have any role whatsoever in the rankings? I mean, the state of Oregon... 50% of our state is owned by either the federal or state governments. Mm-hmm. Does that have any role when you look at the amount of public ownership of the land within a state as it ranks on your rankings here?
We've actually looked at that, and the answer is that the data is inconclusive. I happen to come now from Nevada, where the federal government owns 85% of the state, which is pretty much irrelevant to the state if you happen to have Las Vegas in your state. And that's what we see, is that while, yes, the amount of publicly owned property would seem to have an effect just kind of intuitively, but when you get down to trying to analyze it specifically, there's always some overriding factor that comes into play, such as Las Vegas or the other states that have a lot of federal property tend to be relatively low population states, and something else tends to go on in there that just makes any findings inconclusive, at least.
Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, I wonder if I could have you turn back to your slide on right after the site there on the 2006 information.
Sure.
Chair Warner calls out, maybe they're asking the wrong question if you're looking at ranking with regard to personal income. But these are, in fact, ranked based upon some sort of tax climate that they're trying to, and you'd indicate, I think this was kind of a Bible for those folks that were looking at this, that they were looking for places to site their locations for new operations in the United States. So you'd indicate, or it would be an indication that perhaps with the 2006 information, folks would start looking more carefully at North Carolina or Texas or Ohio, and of course we know that Texas has had significant growth, and there is, you know, some personal income growth there. But I think there must be many more other factors in play with regard to that second calculation, many more than just what would be evident on the surface. I looked down at number 12, and 12 is tied between Illinois and Virginia,
mm-hmm.
and I see one of them has individual personal income growth in the bottom 10 and Virginia in the top 10. So it's an indication that there are a lot more factors in play. And then I would go back just a little bit further in the slides, and much of the information is drawn out for 2002, when Oregon was in its worst economic recession since the Great Depression. And I mean, while we spent a long time using the R word before we would actually come to the utilization of the R word, nobody ever wanted to use the D word when we were talking about the economic downturn that we had. So
yes, but that doesn't sell well.
I'm anxious about the fact that those things, not necessarily on the 2006 ranking for corporate taxes, but I'm anxious that those are the kinds of things that may play into the 2004 data that it shows that they're skewed there.
And I'll say that you're going exactly to the points I would conclude from this. When you focused on the mid-states there, Illinois and Virginia, one very low, one very high. That's sort of the conclusion I draw from this, is with that observation alone, I'd say obviously the criteria is wrong or doesn't matter. The criteria for ranking the states, if you've got two states that have identical ranking, one is at the top in performance, one is at the bottom in performance, whatever you're looking at, whether it's football scores or anything else, that tells you that the criteria you're trying to use to identify good performers is the wrong criteria.
Yeah.
It's very well summed up and exactly on the middle of that chart, but it's the same pattern looking at the entire chart, that it's all over the board. And when you get results that are all over the board, and in fact tend to be negative to what you would expect, you would tend to think a favorable business climate would mean that you had high growth. If it doesn't have that, then something's wrong with your definition of a favorable business climate.
Yes.
And this climate,
yeah,
as the way it's defined by site selection, is heavily focused on taxes and the regulatory environment. And that just seems to say that those things don't drive growth in personal income.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. And so I would guess I would come back to the fact that this is the Bible of those folks, but they read it and really don't care about the results of after their actions.
And what I would say more or less in their defense is they don't necessarily see their goal as being per capita personal income creation. If I were the Secretary of Economic Development in the state, I would probably feel that I was doing my job better if I attracted a major new high-tech company that might not have a lot of employment and might not pay high wages, but still the fact that I located this plant in my state, a big automobile plant is a classic example. They love large plants that come in, those are seen as successes. Where smaller firms that create more jobs with higher wages might not necessarily get on their radar screen. So it's a matter of maybe it works for what their objectives are, but at least to the extent that if their objective is to create more income per person in the state, then this is not a good criteria for it. So, and following on what you're kind of suggesting, maybe there's something else in there. This chart, I went to the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis data and looked at all of the expenditures of corporations in America. You can get the details of everything that they spend on, from paper clips to airlines. On the right-hand side of this particular chart is what they spend for total corporate income taxes. That little, what looks like a compact disc laying on a table, represents 0.25% of their total expenditures go for state income taxes. On the other hand, direct labor cost, which is the product of your educational system, is about 50%, 48% to be exact. Half of what businesses spend on average in America goes for labor. Labor is the biggest cost item they have, biggest single cost by far, and a small change in the quality of your workforce has a huge increase in corporate profitability because it's such a large cost. Taxes could double or could fall by half, and you're still talking about something less than 0.5% of total cost. If you're a corporate decision maker, where is your eye going to focus? Down here or over here? You're going to look at the big cost areas, and the big cost areas are, in fact, that's what the business location people, when we talk to corporate decision makers, to say, why do you actually move one place to the other? And we've got numerous surveys on this that say they move because of workforce-related issues. That's the number one factor they're concerned about, particularly high-tech businesses, but all businesses in general are most concerned about workforce. This chart comes from a fellow. It was actually published in the Federal Reserve Bulletin, but it's from a gentleman that for 20 years was head of Fantas Corporation. It's the largest site relocation advisory company in America. And he published in the Federal Reserve Bulletin this report showing what the average manufacturing firm and the average office tech firm, office firms of the high-tech firms, fall into this category. Their labor share of their total cost of things they consider when making a relocation decision, 72% of their decision was based on labor cost, 5% based on taxes, all forms of taxes. Manufacturing cost was, labor was substantially less in manufacturing, but still the largest single factor. And taxes were done in the 4% range of things that they consider in making their relocation decisions. I've talked so far strictly about business taxes. We've gone through the same analysis looking at individual taxes. Do taxes on individuals matter? And in fact, we get the same general results. I've looked at this over several different sets of time periods. You still find the pattern that the fastest growing states tend to have above average taxes. The lowest growing states tend to have low taxes. And once again, I think that the taxes simply don't explain the full story. It's not that low taxes are bad. It's not that high taxes are good. It's that high taxes are associated with something in addition to simply high taxes. Just out of curiosity, I did the same thing looking at international. If you look at the nations where taxes are the largest share of GDP, you start with Sweden, Denmark, Finland, Norway, the Nordic countries tend to be on the extreme high end, running 45% to 50% of their GDP going to taxes. At the bottom end is Mexico, then Japan, Ireland, Korea, U.S., Australia, Switzerland, Turkey, being at the nations that have about 25% or less going to taxes. And then look at their...
Excuse me, does that include state and local taxes as well as federal taxes?
This is all forms...
Total taxes.
Right, total taxes.
Thank you.
When you look at the growth rate, at the top end, Poland, Luxembourg, you get into the Nordic countries again, Finland, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, tend to be above the global average. And at the bottom end, Mexico was at the bottom in both categories, but special circumstances there, I think. It's a similar pattern when you actually do the statistics on this. The highest taxing nations tend to grow faster. Explanation, well, they also tend to be fairly high. There are two arguments on this. One is that they're high investing nations, that they tend to invest in things that make a difference to economic growth, and that when taxes are a large percentage of your economy, you as policymakers are much more judicious about how you spend the money and how you tax. In relatively low taxing countries, they found that the efficiency of public expenditure is less, because it doesn't make much difference to people. If your tax rate's 10%, you don't pay near as much attention to how you raise and spend that money as if your tax rate is 50%. If you're taking 50% of people's money, they're watching very carefully to see how you spend it. At the other end, they just assume you're wasting it and don't pay much attention to it. And finally, there was a study that came out that looked at fairly intensive data on city growth over a 20-year period, and they found that overwhelmingly education was the factor that caused growth in cities around the country. The permitting process and regulatory issues came in second, and tax incentives were found to have no identifiable relation to growth in cities in their study. But once again, the education, and this is broadly defined, the reason I have education, the results were actually that K-12 education mattered, VOTEC and community colleges mattered, and higher education mattered. Those three education factors came in before whatever came in number two.
Question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Sims, relative to that, and I think education is probably number one in all of that, because that's why the folks would be moving to those cities, would be to get an educated workforce, folks, and it almost, in some respects, it almost goes contrary to an earlier slide that said they were worried about the cost of labor, because the indication would be that the uneducated would give you a less cost of labor. So help me draw the line between those two.
It's very clear that if you were just thinking as a rational business person, thinking of expanding your business, you'd say, do I want to go where costs are less? Clearly you do. Okay, that must mean you want to live in eastern Nevada, because I guarantee you can buy land and hire labor in eastern Nevada very inexpensively. On the other hand, it's not near anything. You've got to truck anything in and out. The labor you get is unskilled. Where does business actually locate? They want low cost. Where do they locate? In Manhattan. Where do they locate? In San Francisco. Where do they locate? In Los Angeles. Seattle. All of the things that you would not logic as a business person. You'd say, I want low rental cost. I want low labor cost. I want low taxes. But you, in the real world, end up locating where actually taxes are high. Because taxes are high where you have a good workforce, because a good workforce is a product of a good educational system. You'd like to have the one without the other, but in fact the two go hand in hand. You don't have good streets and roads unless you have fairly high motor fuels taxes to pay for them. You don't have a good police and fire system unless you have fairly high taxes to pay for them. So while you would like to have low taxes plus a good quality environment, the reality is that the good quality environment is funded by fairly high taxes. That gets back to the explanation of why the taxes show up having insignificant or actually the wrong direction if you only look at taxes.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Dr. Sims.
Yes, ma'am.
In this discussion, one of the things that has not sort of been put on the table, but it appears to me would be a clear divider here, and that is sort of the size of your company. If you're a small growing business in California, you might look north and say, gee, I like it better up there and move up here. But if you get to a certain size, it seems to me, and you are in manufacturing, say, footwear, at some point you're going to look where labor is lower, and it isn't going to be California or Oregon or Washington. You're going to be looking overseas. And that phenomena weighs in here in a huge way. So you're like your site magazine comparison. If our job issues were only around, are we competing with Ohio? It's a very different look, and I can guarantee you that they're not making a lot of footwear in Finland, just a lot of cell phones. So I guess if you could speak to that.
Yes. You may have noticed from my accent, I'm not from around here. I'm from the South originally, and at the time I was first starting to pay attention to such things, we were looking to steal jobs from Massachusetts. And we had low wages. We had low taxes. We had all the things that business was looking for. And we did some serious studies on that. We came out with several reports that looked at how to grow the economy. They still have the Southern Growth Policies Board that still looks at how to steal jobs from Massachusetts or wherever they're looking to now. But we discovered that any jobs we could steal from Massachusetts, Taiwan could steal from us. Mm-hmm. We were fighting the wrong battle. To compete because of low wages just made you were still, any state is going to be uncompetitive relative to other countries in the world if you're only competing on wages. You're always going to be losing labor-intensive jobs that are unskilled jobs. There's no reason why they would stop in Oregon or in Mississippi or anywhere else. They would go where labor is truly cheap. So that's not an effective economic development criteria. Increasing the quality of the workforce, that's how you retain jobs, is making your human capital more valuable. So that, in fact, you create higher-end jobs where you are. But the competing on the low wages, we tried it in the South for a number of years. The very first economic development incentive was in 1936 in Mississippi when they issued the first industrial revenue bonds. Well, we all know how successful Mississippi has been in attracting job growth and income growth over the last 75 years. It hasn't worked out too well. It's been the states that have invested the most in terms of what is the least mobile. Your least mobile resource is your workforce. And if you have a good workforce, whatever else happens, you tend to be resilient and you tend to be growing. People can't compete against you. If you have the best workforce on earth in Oregon, you're going to succeed regardless of what anyone else does. The other things, the low-cost factors tend to be something being from Nevada, I can say this, it's a fool's game because somebody can always undercut you on the cost side. I look in a similar pattern to the ones I looked at on taxes and education spending. This chart shows the rank in K-12 spending per capita out of the 50 states, with Alaska being number one. Alaska always being an exceptional case. New Jersey, number two. New York, three. D.C., my other hometown, number four. Average growth in these states, again, on the personal income criteria, 4.3% over the last decade. Of the states with the lowest spending on a per capita basis, 3.8%. So of the states that have the highest spending on education, growth was a full 0.5% higher than in the low education spending states. And you get the same pattern if you look at taxes again. The low spending states are also the low tax states. They simply go hand in hand. Here, education is the biggest item in the Oregon budget. It's the biggest item in every state's budget. If you see a state that is low taxing, then by definition, it's going to be low education spending. And education clearly matters in business location.
So, Dr. Sims, how would that, just looking at it from an Oregon perspective, we kind of combined the two strategies of being relatively competitive in terms of the tax side, mm-hmm. but also, and it's by luck or by design, we've been able to import highly educated workers to the state, which hopefully, I mean, I think the argument would follow that you would take the growth that you're experiencing, and we're trying to do that as we speak, and reinvest it in our education and higher education system to kind of win on all accounts, win on the competitiveness side, and then climb those rankings in terms of educational attainment by using those imported workers and the wages they bring and the economic growth and the tax revenue that follows mm-hmm. to invest. Is that a...
You have definitely anticipated my next slide. in a little extra sensory perception here, I guess, I looked at what I'm generally calling the degree flow in Oregon. For the last decade, 95 through 2000, you attracted 42,800 more college graduates than you produced. So that was people coming in, people who had been educated elsewhere that moved in here. One of the highest per capita increases in the country. You did very well at attracting college graduates, which makes you feel real good until you look at the sort of overlapping, but I had the data for the 90 to 2000 period that I looked at. From 90 to 2000, you attracted 125,000 college graduates from other states. Note the difference. In 90 to 2000, 124,000, let's call it. And in this 10-year period, shifting forward 5 years, so again, an overlap in there, it was down to 42,000, only a third as much. And what this suggests, and the way I've laid this out isn't fully descriptive, but it's a strong suggestion that in the 90s, you were very successful at the strategy that you're describing. You are much less successful at it now. That you're not attracting as many highly qualified workers from other states as you used to. So you need to keep a close eye on what went wrong. Why is the proportion of college graduates not coming in like it did over the decade of the 90s?
Yeah, Dr. Sims, it looks to me from those numbers that between 2000 and 2005, we might have actually lost graduates during the recession era.
No, you still had an increase, and this measures the net increase of graduates in the state over that period. So you had an increase, but your rate of bringing in new graduates fell down to a third of what it had been.
Well, but look, 123.5 for the decade of the 90s. Mm-hmm. Now, the other number up there includes the last half of the 90s,
right.
42.8. So if the 90s were even, there would have been about 60,000 per five-year period, right? So it looks to me like most or all of those 42 from 95 to 205 came from 95 to 2000.
From this data, that's possible. And in fact, I can look at the yearly numbers and give you a definitive result on that, and I'll be glad to look into that.
I'd like to see that.
I'm not sure from this exactly what years you saw the big drop-off, but I can give you that. I'll make a note in that.
Yeah, the big drop-off was 01, 02, into 03.
Okay, I remember looking at the numbers. That's when we saw the big the downturn tended to be reflected in people. What we know from the study of demographics is that no one is more mobile than someone who was just handed a bachelor's degree. That's the most mobile day in your life is the day you receive your BS degree, and you look at where to locate. So when educators have asked what causes you to locate where you locate on day BS plus one, and more and more each year it tends to be quality of life issues. It's also a factor that when you receive your BS, there's a good chance that you are within a year of having your first child. You either just had a child or you're going to have one in your first year. Where the good schools are is a big factor in your decision criteria. We see that continually when people move in to an area, the first question they tend to ask is, where are the good schools? That's the driving factor on these new graduates. So they're going to be looking at your K-12 school system.
Representative Berger?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Sims, you did indicate when you presented this slide that 42,000 is a good number comparative to other states.
Yes.
And the reason I ask that is that these are numbers, not percentage. In other words, we've had significant growth, and so I guess this bothers me a little because the relativity isn't there.
Yeah, and this is part of a broader study that I was looking at where it's actually controlled for state population and things. I can tell you from the raw data that this is one of the highest increases relative to our highest import level relative to your mm-hmm. population size of any state,
okay.
But it did decline
but it
substantially.
It isn't clear from this.
Yeah, on average, the import rate is zero. So you're right off, you can see you're on the good side of the distribution curve. To actually put it into a full context, I need to go back and adjust the data for size of population, and then I'm also looking at for size of just certain age groups to see how that relates. But this is the overall picture of that on looking total degree flow.
Thank you.
And then sort of getting towards a wrap-up here, I've done a quick look at, I understand that there's some concern in the state on something called the corporate kicker, which I am given to understand is about $275 million. So I use the model that a lot of states use for looking at the fiscal and economic impact of tax and spending proposals to look at the effect of, first, if you spent $275 million on K-12 education, mm-hmm. just exactly as you spend it now, only a little more for each item. No new programs, not changing anything, not going to any different policies, just saying whatever your education spending is now, you add a little fraction to each item in that to a total of $275 million. That would create next year about 12,800 jobs in state. Now, part of these jobs, roughly a third, are going to be teachers and education professionals. About another third, roughly, are people who somehow get income from education but who are not involved. They don't receive a direct check from an education system. The local hardware store who sells supplies that go to the school system, the local automobile dealership that sells the school bus, the service stations that sell the fuel for the school buses, all those fall into about a third of these jobs. And then the remaining third are people who have no connection in any way to the school system that simply benefit because there's more money being circulated in the economy currently. So that total comes out to about 12,800. Now, on the other hand, of course, you've got to pay for this somewhere. Currently, the business system is receiving that $275 million kicker is going back to businesses in the form of of a tax cut as a way to look at that, with some qualifiers that I'll touch on in just a second. If you took that $275 away from business, they've got less profit. They employ some number fewer workers to make goods. The demand for their goods and services is down somewhat, so there's going to be a negative on that. The employment change there would be if you reduce corporate taxes in a permanent way in such an extent to give that same $275 million, that would create about 4,700 jobs in state. Or alternatively, if you took the money out of corporate taxes as it's going out now, it would lose about 4,700 jobs. Now, if you did the two things together, if you did away with the corporate kicker, so you raised money from corporations of $275, and because you have a balanced budget in Oregon, you turn around and you spend the money, and you spend it in K-12 education the way you're currently spending it, so a balanced budget net impact, you end up with a net increase of about 8,100 jobs in the state through the doing away with the money that's going out in the corporate kicker now and putting it into K-12 education. Questions?
Thank you. Dr. Sims, of the one-third of the employment change with the $275 million injected, about one-third of those would be in the education. So you'd grow educational opportunities and grow their education system by 4,000 approximately teachers and support personnel. Does that then the net change down here of 8,000, does that speak anything to the ability to, and certainly from the prior slides, education is supporting, enhancing, and benefiting the overall economy. What does 2009 look like when you don't have the $275 million? You can't sustain it. There's no sustainability. Do we fire the teachers, or does it somehow perpetuate itself?
There are two important qualifiers that you point out here. One is that, starting with the corporate kicker, I've assumed for this analysis that there's a permanent tax cut.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, the way I understand the corporate kicker right now, it has zero value as a business incentive, because you don't get your kicker until after you've already made your business decisions, done everything you're going to do, and then you find out what your tax is going to be. Well, from an economic development standpoint, you couldn't waste money any better than that. Because there's no payoff to the state from giving money back. The whole purpose of giving assistance to business and cutting taxes is to cause them to do something they weren't going to do anyway. Well, your kicker, the way it's structured, the way I understand it, cannot possibly cause anybody to do something that they weren't going to do anyway, because they've already done it before you decide what it's going to be. So I wouldn't question anyone's intelligence and logic on that, but to me, I just can't imagine a worse way to spend money.
Well, none of us were here when we instituted it, so you're safe. You can question all of us, because I don't think any of us were sitting here when that law was devised. Yeah. One was here, and he voted no when that unique to Oregon law was
I
put into place.
So when I came up with the corporate figures on this, shown in the middle of this chart, that's assuming a permanent tax change in the amount of $275 million. In fact, the value on your kicker, if I was analyzing this now for the Department of Revenue, I'd just have to say it's zero, because nothing's going to happen because of the kicker. It just doesn't cause anything. No one makes an investment because of the kicker. It doesn't say that you've got lower taxes. So I'm actually assuming an unreal situation. I'm assuming that that's permanent. It's something that your business community can count on year after year in 09 and 10 and into future years, because they're not going to make an investment decision based on a one-year change, much less a no-year change.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be a permanent change to cause them to make permanent investment decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you don't have right now. You're minimizing your return from your expenditure on that.
While we're on this topic,
sure.
It occurs to me that one of the issues in the state, Oregon state tax system, is the volatility of our taxes, so that it's difficult to predict
mm-hmm.
how much money we're going to have. One of the proposed solutions that we have to that problem is that we establish a savings account to be used during the time when our system doesn't collect as much money as we thought it was going to.
Mm-hmm.
If, in fact, you're right that the corporate kicker doesn't produce anything for us in the economy, mightn't it make more sense, given the totality of the situation, to put that money in the savings account and save it for that rainy day?
From an economic standpoint, it would just be infinitely better. At least you would have the money to use in-state. It would cause some positive outcomes, and you have discretion to be able to use it just exactly when you need it in downturns. There's numerous ways you can structure these rainy day funds, but a well-structured rainy day fund with a funding source such as a corporate tax. For my sins, I used to have to forecast corporate income taxes. when we would go to the Federation of Tax Administrators would have meetings of all the people that we must have been some terrible people in a previous life. The average error in forecasting corporate taxes was 34% year to year across the 50 states. To put that in context, the average error for individual taxes was in the 3-4% range. The corporate tax, if you got within 25%, you got stars beside your name. You were doing really good. If you got within 10%, you got them taken away because someone knew you were doing something wrong, you just guessed. The way corporate reportable taxes work, they're just unforecastable in any kind of reliable sense. So you have putting money into a rainy day fund or some sort of stabilization fund can be a very good thing for the state, and using a funding source that's very volatile is a way to smooth out both your budgetary situation and the state's economy, because you're able to spend it from an economic standpoint. You're able to pump money into the economy just when you need that stimulation, when your people are unemployed, when their income is falling. Then you have a fund set aside to be able to pump it into their hands to get them over downturns in the business cycle that invariably happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Dr. Sims, the model that we have before us, then, if it was sustainable and used on a regular basis and available, would gin up 8,100 new jobs. I'm trying to encapsulate what you've just added to that now. Return to the corporations themselves that have paid it creates potentially 4,700 jobs, but the corporations would decide yay or nay as to whether or not they could actually sustain that kind of growth themselves. It appears that if I can kind of extrapolate the information. And finally, if we were to put the $275 million, if we were to take it away from the corporation, because constitutionally it belongs to those corporations,
mm-hmm.
if we were to take it away so that they couldn't generate 4,700 jobs, but then we put it into a savings account, it wouldn't really generate any new jobs?
If you put 100% of it into a savings account, it would not generate jobs that year, because the money is essentially gone out of the system. You put it in a lockbox, and so you're not spending it through the state budget. You set it aside. So for that year, just like if you're saving for your children's college, money that you put in their college account, you don't get to spend that year.
So follow
it spends
up
in future years.
We have to let Dr. Sims, because we're not going to have enough time for Dr. Romero, who we want to get both perspectives, and we appreciate your indulgence. You are giving us a lot of food for thought, and we really appreciate it.
I'll do a quick wrap-up. You'll have these available to you, so I had some a little additional quotes and information regarding what some people said about funding and business taxes and education. The main kind of walkaway on this is that education spending tends to benefit the state because it's very labor intensive. When you spend for education, 85% of what you spend goes directly into jobs. It's very local purchase intensive. That spending is spent within state. Very little of your school spending leaves the state. You don't offshore or outsource education. And it represents a very large share of business costs. Consequently, when you improve education, that goes to the bottom line of business. It makes the workforce more productive. That's how they profit. That's how business grows, and that's how profits arise, is when the workforce becomes more productive. With that, I'll be glad to take any questions.
Thank you.
Would you be able to provide us with an electronic version of your slideshow?
Yes.
Some of these slides are extremely beneficial.
We have it. You have it.
Thank you.
Dr. Sims, thank you very much for traveling to our state. If you've definitely piqued our interest, if you could stick around with, if you have time, Dr. Romero is going to present next, and if we could hold,
okay,
hold questions, if you are available, we'll try to perhaps have both available to us. But we really appreciate your presentation and your willingness to come to our state and. We've benefited from it.
I'll certainly be available, and I'll follow up on the question regarding the degree flows. And if you have other questions, don't hesitate to contact me.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate you having me here. Thank you very much.
You paid for him to be here.
It was kind of forgetting. I'll say it again.
Oh, okay.
Next up, Dr. Philip Romero, who is another leading economist in the country, was Governor Pete Wilson's economic czar, was referred to as the starting quarterback for the New York Giants before he arrived here, Philip Sims. But we are really benefiting from the now on the faculty at the University of Oregon, but one of the most eloquent spokespersons and economists in the country, and we're lucky to have you here with us.
Well, that's very high praise, Senator. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Butler, and the rest of the committee. As Senator Deckert said, I was an active warrior in the tax wars in the 1990s. I was chief economist to Governor Pete Wilson of California for 8 years. During that time, California, in the beginning of our term, California underwent its worst recession since the Great Depression. It would make the 01, 02, 03 recession in Oregon look pretty tame by comparison. We were losing 1,000 jobs a day. And I was the spear carrier for the design and implementation of a variety of public policies to turn the economy around, and much of that, not by no means all of it, but much of it was centered on corporate tax reductions. And those of you who know economic history know that it was very successful. We went from our worst downturn in history to our greatest boom in history. I by no means believe that tax cuts or our policies get all the credit for it, but unquestionably they get some of it. I think it's great that you folks are educating yourselves on these subjects, because once the session begins again, you will be inundated by lobbyists from both sides who will be arguing for or against tax increases or for or against tax decreases. The advantage of people like Dr. Sims and myself is because we don't have direct dogs in this fight. We can try to be a little more objective. I think I'm probably here somewhat to try to counterbalance what Dr. Sims said. I actually agree with him on quite a bit of it, but I want to divide these decisions into two very broad issues. One is, in essence, how we should structure and what criteria we should use for considering changes in tax policy, which is largely an economic and a technical issue. And then the other, which is the one that Dr. Sims was focusing on, which is in essence how we should set priorities about how we spend the public's money. And let's, although there's a lot of rhetoric to the contrary, let's not mince any words. If you consider a cut in taxes, you are by definition reducing the funds available for some other program like education. Okay. The I think the area where I agree with Dr. Sims strongly is that of all the various alternative public spending programs, probably among the ones that are the most economically beneficial are education, on two main grounds, and he touched on both of them. In the short run, as he said, they're very labor intensive, so a very large fraction of the dollars gets spent on employment and specifically on local employment, because as you said, we're still some distance in the future before we'll be able to outsource face-to-face education to say China or India or someplace like that. Although face-to-face education through an internet connection is coming, and in my industry, higher ed, it's happening more and more often. I strongly disagree with the belief that reductions in corporate taxes are of minimal economic benefit. And in particular, I'll make one point about that. In my review of this kind of work, and I'm getting back involved in it through a consultant to California companies these days, I think the best work these days to try to compare states' competitiveness is work done by the Pacific Research Institute. Now, full disclosure, I'm a senior fellow at PRI, but I didn't do the work. I'm not flocking my own work. This is done by other people. You have probably seen, or you will certainly see, a number of indexes or comparisons of states on various metrics. Most of them are designed, most of them cherry pick particular components meant to make the case of the advocate presenting them. I see some nods of heads. You've obviously got some experience with this. The right way to do something like that is to you choose your components of your index to compare states on the basis of which ones seem to demonstrably affect important economic outcomes. And the one that I think is most relevant is per capita income. PRI did that. PRI, actually, the components of its index are based on best predict two things. One is net migration. I think the belief is that the more opportunity you provide, the more people are going to come to you. Net migration being the difference between people leaving the state and people coming into the state. And the other is per capita income. Per capita income is really the fundamental measure of prosperity. It's how much income we each have on average. PRI's index, which is called the forgive me, I'm blanking on the name of it. It's in my testimony. Yeah, Index of U.S. Economic Freedom. They didn't, like most, cherry-pick exclusively measures that were of interest to them. They looked at a wide range of differences among states and did statistical analysis to determine which ones seem to explain the greatest variation among the states. Economic freedom is itself a nested index with a variety of metrics, including things like protection of property rights, discipline in the tort system, and then also taxes and spending. And my testimony says specifically how much, but I think about 60% of the variation among states is ultimately explainable through fiscal measures like taxes and spending. So I think there's no question in my mind, as I said, among public programs, I think that education spending is among the most productive economically. I believe there are a number of situations in which reductions in revenues, and therefore putting more money in the pockets of taxpayers, either corporate or individual, can be more productive economically. And I think PRI's index and evaluation of or comparison to different states is, I think, currently the most authoritative demonstration of that point. Let me turn for a moment now out of the out of the issue of whether we should be collecting taxes or giving them back to corporations. And let me talk a little bit more now about specific elements of tax policy. The first one I want to talk about is the whole issue of tax incentives. First of all, I'll sort of telegraph my main point, and then I'll talk about some of the technical details. I'm a strong believer that while you may occasionally have to provide so-called targeted tax breaks to attract particular facilities, that in general is a loser's game. First of all, as Dr. Sim said, if the only reason you can compete is because of subsidies and low costs, that's a very temporary advantage. So, bless you, temporary and unsustainable advantage. Secondly, very few targeted tax incentives are at all performance based. So you may provide a substantial reduction in taxes to a corporate client now, and only see the job stay for a few years. I used when I was in government and in my continuing research, I used a couple of different metrics that I lay out in my written testimony for evaluating tax breaks. But they really all boil down to this, which is, if you think of it, you think of any government expenditure as an investment, and a reduction in taxes are essentially an investment. So in my example here, let's say to attract a facility that will employ 100 people making an average of $50,000 a year, let's say it costs $10 million in reduced taxes to do that. You can then compute what those 100 jobs will generate in tax revenues, and you can compare the benefit in terms of that additional tax revenue from those 100 jobs to the cost in terms of the reduced taxes, and thereby compute in essence a return on your investment, just like any company would do about any of its investments. In my particular example, it would take, if you spent $10 million on targeted tax cuts to attract 100 jobs, you would take you roughly 33 years for that investment to pay for itself. And that's not very attractive. On the other hand, if it attracted 1,000 jobs, it would take 3 years to pay for itself, and that is attractive. My point is not, and this is obviously a hypothetical example, my point is not for you to focus on the specific numbers, but my point is simply that approaches like this, and I mentioned two other yardsticks in my written testimony as well, I think are much more reasonable economically driven ways to evaluate tax incentives than what's usually done, which is make it purely politically driven. I think the last point I want to make, and then I'll be happy to take questions, is just a couple of other general thoughts about tax policy. These are a little bit beyond part of the scope of this discussion, but since I have the floor for them, I will take advantage of it. The first one is the whole issue of volatility. As Dr. Sims just mentioned, corporate tax rates are extraordinarily hard to predict, and the reason for that, and personal income taxes, while less hard, the common reason is the same, which is capital gains. Oregon, as I believe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it is the most dependent on capital gains as a fraction of its revenue flow of any state in the country. Is that correct, Paul?
In terms of personal income taxes, yeah. Yes, and so capital gains is a component.
I've seen this in California. I mean, just recently, California has been seeing revenue increases that has allowed the Governor Schwarzenegger and the legislature to largely defer hard decisions because revenues are up. And when you peel that onion a little bit, you find that is really just the good fortunes of a couple of billionaires who've literally just a couple of billionaires who sold some stock. So guess what? In boom years, revenues surge, and in bust years, they crash. And in my observation, at least in California, I won't speak for the mature and disciplined Oregon legislature, but in my experience, when there's a boom, of course, the legislature regularly commits to long-term liabilities on what were basically short-term windfalls. So I personally believe strongly that a very important technical challenge for revenue policymakers is to reduce volatility, and that means ultimately, I think, reducing the share of state revenues that come from capital gains-driven income taxes, either be they a personal or a corporate, and probably replacing those with consumption taxes. Now, you know, I know the checkered history, not the checkered, the unremitting negative history of sales taxes in Oregon, and I'm not politically astute enough to know. Tell you how to sell it, but from an economist's point of view, for a number of reasons, I think reducing our income taxes and increasing our sales taxes is the right, or having a sales tax is the right thing to do.
Representative Butler has a plan to achieve just that.
Oh,
a couple of us are following along.
Please
with
sign
it.
Me up. Yeah, I did not know that. I hope that wasn't sarcastic. The other just brief comment I'll make, and then I'll stop, is that whenever one considers any sort of tax cut, I think it's demonstrable economically that it is skewing it towards maximizing reductions in capital gains rates tend to be the most economically productive. General thing, and the economists will tell you, is you want to tax the things you don't want more of, and you want to reduce taxes on the things you do want more of. And we want capital formation. Now, it is absolutely true. I mean, a counter-argument is that capital is very, very mobile. And so reducing capital gains, the question is, how do you keep the capital in the state? And the way you keep the capital in the state is by having low tax rates in general so that opportunity is being created. Final comment I'll just make is that for those who are centrist or right of center who believe in general in relatively low taxes, there nevertheless remains a debate about whether we should reduce taxes for a given dollar reduction. Should we reduce them for all, or should we target them for particular purposes? I think it's generally demonstrable that the government has no special wisdom in choosing winners and losers or choosing the worthy and the unworthy. And I think you can improve opportunity better if you lower rates in general, I mean, for a given dollar reduction, than if you try to target them to specific industries or specific companies. If you look at the, if you look at the indiscipline of every round of congressional tax legislation, you'll see massive giveaways to specific companies or industries. The most recent example was, I think, in 2004, and maybe it was 2005. In order to conform to new WTO rules, the U.S. had to make some relatively minor technical changes in its tax code. At the end of the day, it was, I think, a $700 billion bill. Because it was a Christmas tree loaded up with giveaways for lobbyists. That is both offensive morally and politically, and it's also bad economically. So forgive that somewhat random presentation, but I wanted to touch on a couple of points that Dr. Sims made, and if there's time, I'll be happy to take questions. Or if you want to bring us both up here and have a dueling dueling advocates, we can do that too.
Well, thank you very, very much. Perhaps we'll give a little bit of time for Dr. Romero, and then we'll, if Dr. Sims looks like he's still available, we'll have sure. The two of you. But we really appreciate making the trip and sharing your thoughts with us.
I'll just mention in passing that the packet that I provided you has my testimony is quite brief. It's only a couple pages, but then there's a variety of op-eds I've written that touch on the subject, and a bit of data from mainly from the both from the PRI study I mentioned, and also a little scorecard I did on Oregon competitiveness about a year ago. Huh.
So one of the natural questions one has is, as we cast an eye towards your old state, and then we look at San Francisco or Los Angeles, and just up north towards the state of Washington, and we see relatively higher rates on personal income and corporate income in terms of rates, but we see the wage per capita income, which is probably the best indice, right. I would agree with you. You see the per capita income so high and growing at such a fast clip. I think the natural question for that sandwich state of Oregon is, what ought we be doing, and given an economist point of view of would Oregon be best if we even raised our whether it's personal income or corporate and put that money into higher education to attract that stop importing so much and actually have that critical mass of highly educated citizens? What would your view be if that was a direct question for Oregon?
Well, as a beneficiary of that spending, you can that position. No, I actually think that's a very good idea. I mean, even if I try to be dispassionate about it, but with an important caveat. And I think Dr. Sims would probably agree with me on this. The what's implied by your question is you're right. Large states who've already achieved critical mass, like California, can substantially free ride on other states' education systems. So they can accept immigration from those other education systems. Our per capita income is lower in part because we have a slightly lower, not a lot lower, but a slightly lower fraction of our adult workforce that has college educations. The direct response is just what you said, which is you need to increase educational opportunities. And at a time when the federal government is retrenching in that area, it's especially important for states to do it. My boss, Dave Fornemeyer, the president of Oregon, likes to say that we once were state sponsored, then we were state subsidized, now we're state located. There's another critical element, which is you can produce all the hot college graduates you want, but if they don't have any jobs, all you're doing is subsidizing other states because those people emigrate elsewhere. So while that's a very important strategy, it needs to be married up with strategies that make it easier for the corporate sector to create jobs.
Senator George.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Turbin. On your attracting business section, you made the following comment. The two areas I hear most often from Oregon business leaders, that, in other words, problems, are taxes, especially business taxes, land use restrictions, and procedure. But back over here, you pointed out that last fall, dozens of CEOs, company CEOs, met and to set a policy proposal for including sales taxes.
Right.
Now, when I look at sales taxes, I see this as corporations trying to give themselves a tax break, which you would indicate would be favorable, but shifting that to the least able to pay on a sales tax because it is a regressive tax. A sales tax affects the poor the most. Can you give me your balance on that?
Yeah, sure. First on the whole regressiveness issue, does everybody here know the difference between regressive and progressive? Okay, good. I need to define that. California tries to handle regressivity by exempting a lot of certain necessities, food, clothing, things like that. You can imagine the kind of games that get played there. I think a much more effective approach would simply be to have a very high standard exemption. So the first $40,000-$50,000, for example, you get back in the form of a refundable tax credit. So you're de facto not really paying sales taxes on that portion. Again, I'm not an expert on this, but something like that seems like a fairly simple way to get around the regressivity point. To your comment about CEOs endorsing sales tax, you could well be right. I can't get in the minds of all the people who signed that thing. It's possible that some of them were simply doing it as a clever game to try to shift a tax burden from themselves to essentially their customers. This is what it boils down to. But I do know some of them, and for those I know about whom I talked about this, I really believe they have a sincere belief in what I was saying a moment ago, which is that revenue volatility is not just a technical issue. It also ends up becoming a very important political issue because when we have boom times, we overspend. And when we have bad times, we're not necessarily very judicious about where we make the cuts. And these CEOs who have operated in a cyclical environment much longer than a typical term-limited politician realize that smooth, and they who have to, they have to appeal to Wall Street by showing smooth earnings growth, realize the importance of trying to reduce volatility. So I can't speak for all of them, but my guess is that was the logic behind most of their thinking.
Could I do a follow-up?
Sure.
Yesterday in this room, we learned something, and you mentioned sin taxes and the fact that they seem to have the least overall effect on the economy. One of the things we learned is we may collect over $200 million worth of taxes on hard liquor. When it comes to beer and wine, we collect $7 million, I believe it was. Yeah. What was it?
Seven
each. $7 million.
And how much for hard liquor?
234, I think.
Okay.
$234 million. The question is that I asked the question in that committee about the fact that, you know, most of our accidents on our highways involving drunk drivers. Wouldn't it be smart, for example, since we're trying to fund state police, that we would in fact have a tax on beer and wine that would go to the state police? Now, what would be your opinion as far as the impact on business that way? What we're talking about here is 4.7, this is a six-pack of beer, 4.7 cents for a six-pack of beer. So, to me, that would be insignificant as far as discouraging the use of the product, but would, in fact, help us to backfill a shortfall in the budget. Any thoughts on that?
Just a quick thought. I mean, obviously, all I know about this is what you just told me, but I think the what's called the elasticity of demand, which is by what percent does the consumption of beer go down per 1% change in price, and 4.7 cent tax increase is only about a 1% increase in price. I think it's around 0.3 or 0.4. So you probably see for that 1% increase in the price of beer, you probably see about a 0.3% decline in beer sales. A technical point: often revenue forecasters don't bother to think about elasticity, so they don't realize that when you raise the price of something through taxes, you're going to see some reduction in purchases. My understanding is that aside from microbrews, there are very few significant brewing operations in Oregon, so my guess is that fairly modest reduction in beer consumption will largely be felt by national breweries. I mean, there will be some Oregon loss, but not a lot. I mean, I can't in my head tell you what the numbers are, but it's not zero, but it's small.
Mm-hmm.
And if the legislature thinks that the public purpose of making more money available for state police is important, this does not strike me as a very significant economic cost to achieve that public purpose.
With regard to mixed drinks, the economic elasticity of a tax increase on mixed drinks is zero because nobody has ever asked the price of a mixed drink. There's no. You can increase the price by
spoken like a good Kentuckian.
Jack Daniels. No one asked the price, so if you add 10% to an unknown, it has no effect. You could increase your alcohol taxes substantially with no loss of sales. The beer being more sensitive because people kind of know what they pay for a case of beer, but no one knows what they pay for a Tom Collins or something like that.
And I'm speculating here, but I'm guessing that the average income level of a hard liquor drinker is probably a little higher than a beer drinker, so therefore they're less price sensitive also. But I think we're both agreeing that you will hear from breweries and distributors how horrible this is, but I think the numbers are small, and as I said, I think they're going to be largely export the economic impact outside of the state. And I always believe in taxing my residents as little as possible and taxing outsiders as much as possible.
Cinnamon Row, and then we'll go down there.
Dr. Romero, you didn't comment on the $275 million corporate kicker and whether we ought to put it in a rainy day fund or spend it on education or give it back to the corporations in a massive tax cut next year.
You caught me, Senator Romero. I actually thought about including this in my testimony, but I didn't because I think my thoughts are more fundamentally political than economic. Without question, I mentioned the importance of reducing revenue volatility, and without question, a rainy day fund would in principle aid in that cause. But my experience from observing the California legislature and Congress over the last 20 years is there are no lockboxes. I'm not a constitutional lawyer, and Dr. Sins mentioned something that suggests there might be ways to design a rainy day fund to actually lock it, triple lock it, seal it in concrete, so it is only used for legislative, for a rainy day purposes. But in my observation, I'll give you an example. In the early 80s, the Greenspan Commission recommended a series of reforms to Social Security, including the creation of a trust fund. And ever since, we've been paying a heavier payroll tax than is needed to cover current Social Security liabilities, theoretically to build up a fund to protect against when the baby boomers retire. Well, is there a fund? No, only as an accounting, as an accounting fiction. It's all been spent. And I've seen that, I've seen the California legislature before as well. So I am not smart enough, imaginative enough, or knowledgeable enough about constitutional law to know how you make the lockbox really lock down. But do you have any thoughts on this?
There are a few states that that actually have rainy day funds that are more or less sacred. I believe Alabama is one of the states that their members won't touch the rainy day fund on anything short of Katrina. In other states, it's more or less a slush fund that the first time revenues come through $10 short, they reach into the kitty and pay for it like it was petty cash. But you can, in fact, structure a rainy day fund if you were creating one where it anticipated business cycles, it anticipated normal downturns, set those aside, and was a true disaster. You think in advance. You write legislation. You know how to do this. You think in advance of what the possibilities might be, and put it in the original bill. And you could structure one that would actually accomplish the purpose that you're trying to accomplish.
It is doable. I think, and no pride of authorship, I think the way we've designed the Education Stability Fund, constitutional. If you look at the economic triggers that we've put into it. Here in Oregon, it's inadequate in the dollars in it. Mm-hmm. The only time that we would have actually been able to, us here, actually access it, given the economic triggers, are the 80s recession met that test. Mm-hmm. The last recession, which was pretty large, met that test. And then briefly, the 90s, more shallow recession, but briefly, and to me that was a good sign that you really, the only two times you hit it were real recessions in the early 80s and then the early 2000s that you really would have been able to access it.
Well, just to sort of close this off and finish my answer to Senator Monroe's question, if there is a way to design it so it really is used that infrequently, only under conditions where it's intended, as Senator Decker, you just illustrated for the Education Stability Fund, then I'd be very much in favor of directing any kicker money into a rainy day fund. But I will just close with proper cynicism, educated by past experience, that I think clever lawyers and lobbyists and the legislators who listen to them can be remarkably imaginative at finding ways to create exceptions.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yes,
and 20 years ago, when I chaired the Senate Revenue Committee, Senator Houck, who was the ranking minority on that committee, and I wrote such a rainy day bill. Hmm. That passed the Senate overwhelmingly with bipartisan support and was killed in the House, that would have only allowed access to that money in case where the revenue forecast, where the actual revenue came in well below the revenue forecast and we were faced with cutting education and so on. Right. Other than that, it took a supermajority, both houses, and signature by the governor to access it, so it was locked up pretty tight.
Right.
But to Dr. Sims, one of the figures that you gave us was that if the corporations were given the $275 million, that it could create 4,700 jobs. But I think you said that that would only be the case if it was a permanent cut year after year, but that if they only received it once, which is the way our law is written, that it would create zero new jobs. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Can I I'd just like to touch on that broader version of Senator Monroe's question there? Among centrists who are generally in favor of tax cuts, there's a raging debate on this issue. And this came up a lot during the early part of this decade when President Bush was pushing tax cuts. Centrist Democrats would argue, well, yeah, we need to cut taxes so that we can stimulate the economy out of recession, but they should be temporary. Economic research has generally shown, as Dr. Sins answered Senator Monroe's question, I think is consistent with this, that in general, tax cuts have the greatest incentive effect when you can plan on them, i.e. when you expect them to be permanent. So I would not go so far as to say a temporary tax cut will have zero effect, but it clearly will have much, much less effect than the same size tax cut where you provided some certainty to the business community that they're going to get in the future as well.
Down this way, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Romero, I appreciated your comments about the lack of hard economic data that's often advanced in support of or opposition to various proposed changes. We have a couple of tools that have been created here in Oregon to evaluate the effect of proposed changes in our tax system, and one of those is the Oregon Tax Incidence Model.
Right.
The other is the tax expenditure report that comes out. So have you looked at either of those tools, and do you think that they are helpful in giving us some objective information when we're looking at these changes?
Representative Rosenbaum, in the early 90s, I pioneered so-called dynamic revenue analysis in California, and created a monster. the legislature then wrote a bill that, which was passed and is now law that requires the state equivalent of LRO, which is the Department of Finance, to do dynamic analyses on all bill analyses above a certain level. I got one briefing on OTM a couple of years ago. I was very pleased to see, and I can't remember the details right now, but I do recall thinking, I think OTIM is actually more sophisticated than the model of California Department of Finance has. The tax expenditure report, I've looked at it occasionally. Most states and the federal government are required to do those periodically. To my knowledge, and perhaps Paul Warner can correct me if I'm wrong, but to my knowledge, the tax expenditure reports are done on a strictly static basis. Is that correct?
The tax
expenditure report.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, and they're really based on returns, analysis of returns and credits.
Okay.
And so forth.
But just since I'm talking about static versus dynamic, I want to make one other comment, which is that while there are conservatives who will argue that dynamic analysis can completely overturn the results of static analysis. Actually, before I go on, do I need to define the difference? Okay, good. So static analysis is simply an arithmetical exercise. You have a tax that collects $1 billion now, and you cut it by 10%, you're going to lose $100 million. Dynamic analysis tries to reflect the behavioral consequences of that, i.e., corporations will do something with that $100 million that will generate some jobs using the kind of multipliers that Dr. Sim showed you. I've done a lot of dynamic analysis over the years. In fact, I just did some for the California Franchise Tax Board about 2 weeks ago. Generally, the difference between dynamic and static are not all that large. For example, the work I just did, I found that dynamic analysis shaved the revenue loss by about 20%. I can't imagine a case where a dynamic analysis would cause you to conclude a revenue cut entirely paid for itself in the short run. You know, it will reduce the effects. It won't eliminate them entirely.
Thank you.
Others on this side? Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciated the discussion this morning, and lots of food for thought here. A lot has transpired since I came up with my question. It dealt with elasticity. And I'd like to come back to the issue of elasticity when it comes to where Oregon has no sales or use taxes. Technically we do, but really stated we don't. Is elasticity, for instance, with regard to beer and wine, when you're somewhere in the bottom five states that have beer and wine taxes? I think we had an analysis the other day showing we were about 48th. lowest beer consumption tax in, of any state in the nation, and we have no sales tax on top of that. Is elasticity as big of an item when you at the very bottom? I recognize that in tobacco, where it's extremely accessible over the internet, and folks can pick up cartons or cases in a hurry over that method. Is elasticity as big of a deal when you're talking about a beer tax when you're at the very bottom, the gray market and those kinds of things?
I'd certainly say it is not. The classic example is salt. What if the price of salt doubles? Who knows what salt costs? It doesn't matter. Well, the price of beer is down. It's a small part of anybody's total expenditure. At least we hope it is. A change in the tax on something that's a small part of your expenditure is simply not going to affect the base. But people don't drink more beer. When we've looked in years ago, we did some pretty extensive studies on this. People don't drink more beer in places where beer prices, total prices, are low, or less beer where it's high. It's just not that price is not the big factor in deciding whether you'd like a beer or not.
Just to follow up, then, if I may, so really, the elasticity really doesn't come in at that particular point.
Not as much as you would perhaps on
some other items like tobacco or pencils or something like that. And finally, I want to just give a pitch, Mr. Chair, that I really am anxious about static versus dynamic modeling in this state, and I appreciate the good work that's been done in updating the OTIMS model at this particular point, but I'd also like to say that it's always, I mean, any time you say, well, this particular opportunity to bring in this new industry into Oregon will cost us this much because we're going to extend this kind of a credit, just on a static level, folks will say, no, they'll make the decision to come here without it. So don't offer that. So, I mean, if you've got that kind of controversy over just the top level of it, it really gets controversial the further down you go and you say, well, look at the jobs that it created here and the jobs and the spinoff that it created there.
As an old modeler, the big hang-up on dynamic modeling is you can tell me which tax you want to cut or increase. And I can work out fairly well the full dynamic implications of that. But you unfortunately have to live within a balanced budget requirement, so I haven't done my full job until I said, and Representative, which expenditure do we want to cut? Because you can't do one without the other to see what the impact is. And every expenditure has its own unique dynamic aspects as well. That's why the one I was modeling for you is exactly an example of that. If you raise a corporate tax and use it to fund K-12 education, you get the results I was showing you. You could spend that money for streets and roads and get a different result. You could spend it for public security and get a different result. So you have to bear that part in mind. That's where you really get into a complex issues, is that a modeler has to ask, when you tell me to lose revenue from a tax side, I also have to lose it on the expenditure side. What do we want to do there?
Great, thank you.
This may be stating the obvious, but I don't think it will surprise any of you if I say that the debates about whether one should be using static or dynamic analysis in a given context are really not about technical issues. You know, they're really fundamentally between advocates of particular positions who are using technical arguments as stalking horses for their real positions. And as I said, as someone who's a big believer in dynamic analysis, I will tell you that it is very often oversold. It definitely does cause a reduction in the effective loss in revenues from, say, a tax cut. But it's a 20, 30, 50% reduction. It's not a 100% reduction. As I said, dynamic analysis will very rarely prove that a tax cut pays for itself. And I want to just amplify something Dr. Sim said. He's absolutely right that every industry has its own value added per worker and therefore its own multiplier, like the multipliers Dr. Sims used. And so where the money goes will very much affect how productive the tax cut is or how costly the economy the tax increase is.
Yeah, please, Paul.
I just add for our House members, the timing of this discussion is good because that's kind of a topic we'll talk about at our 1 o'clock meeting with the OTIM and kind of the difference between static and dynamic analysis.
So, everyone come.
So, Dr. Simmons, just one other question that's in the back of my head, and it was early in your presentation. It was the idea that states sometimes err in incenting large companies rather than small companies. And so I've always believed, but never seen great research done on it, that, and it's somewhat anecdotal, but I'll take Genentech in my neck of the woods. The idea that we would incent through several factors this obviously national company that's choosing Oregon to hopefully, and they've made the decision to locate and hopefully grow. And then I talked to, and this is purely anecdotal, but it certainly makes sense, talked to friends, whether it's in the smaller businesses that feed off of, whether it's the furniture company or the retail shop, and all a level of excitement that perhaps another great and all, and whether it's the realtors in my neighborhood who, if I look around, whether it's Nike or Intel or others, and I look at the home values, I just see the ancillary effect everywhere. You can't turn around and miss it. And so I've just kind of bought into that notion that Genentech, more wealth is going to be produced from the traded sector, and it's going to flow to the service sector. But I could be off on
That's what we have classically hoped would happen, that we would create the next Silicon Valley. I've been doing this long enough to one of the next Route 28 that was the Massachusetts Silicon Valley. The next, every, I went through Wang Laboratories. You might remember Wang Computers. When the chairman, Dr. Wang, had a map on his wall with pins in it from all of the delegates from the various states. Every state except one had been there, each of which was going to be the next Route 128. Well, the mathematics says that ain't going to happen. More focused on your question, it would be nice if you could do a policy that would cause a major firm to locate there. The problem is that most firms locate for things that you have nothing to do with. And when Toyota came to Kentucky, we gave them what came out to be $128,000 a job to locate there. The average manufacturing firm in America has invested something around $76,000 per worker. We could have bought Toyota. We could have built it ourselves and called it the Kentucky Thoroughbred Car Plant and come out money ahead. My sort of bottom line from that ramble is if you could cause it to happen and truly you knew you caused something to happen, it would be a good thing. The fact is there's no policy that you can enact that's going to cause the next large employer to locate here that wasn't 99% sure they're going to locate here anyway.
I would I look at the SIP, the Strategic Investment Program that this state did, and you could pencil it out in terms of the property taxes that a large technology company would have to pay. I mean, it would just, to me, it would pencil out at that point. It just makes rational sense why they would ever locate just on the property tax side because of,
if they dropped out of a spaceship and landed there, it's a wonderful thing. But I was just last month in Tennessee looking at the results of the Saturn plant is asking for a new incentive package to expand. Mm-hmm. We went back and analyzed the old incentive package they were given to locate in Spring Hill 15 years ago. And the Murray County, where it's located, is worse off today than it was before Saturn came there, in terms both of fiscal structure, property taxes, and so forth, in terms of average income relative to the state, all of these criteria, it wishes Saturn had never happened to it. So it's really, while again we would like to have a high tech center or a medical center in Minnesota, working with some high end medical centers, trying to create a medical corridor. It actually is a medical corridor there. You like for that to happen, but it didn't happen because of a policy, because the state couldn't write a check for the entire state treasury big enough to cause those kind of changes to take place. They happen for more fundamental market reasons. And the reason I mentioned focusing on small business grows and locates based on more fundamental things like the quality of the local environment. They tend to be more connected. The profits tend to stay in state.
Yeah.
A small business owner lives here.
Yeah.
They have more of a personal investment in the community. When a tax referendum is up, they're more likely to say, it's a good thing because my kids go to that school or that school's in my community. I relate to that school. The big firms are globally owned. They make fiduciary decisions based on global considerations. So.
I can just add one brief note to that. I agree with everything Dr. Simmons has said, but in my casual review of what determines state economic performance, my sense is that I can't tell you this scientifically. This is just my impression based on 15 years in this business. The rate at which firms are born in a state is one of the strongest is one of the strongest determinants of prosperity, and by definition, newly born firms are small firms.
Yes, overwhelmingly.
One last question, Senator George.
Right. Thank you very much. I'll go to Dr. Sims first, and then Mr. Romero, if you could answer, too. We talked about the $275 million corporate kicker going to schools, but there really is another alternative that was talked about here, and I want to ask you your opinion of the consequence. Okay. All right. We have a $50 million budget. That's what we're going to pass out here, $50 billion. And this is $275 versus $50,000 million. So it's a very significant number. But if we took the money, the $275 million, and we put it in a reserve account, it's going to get invested by our state treasurer mainly out of the state. Okay? What impact would that have, that $275 million basically going into a reserve account? Sure, we have a reserve account, and that's a good thing. I've advocated for years. But if the investments during the period of time that it's growing would be invested out of the state or out of the country?
Generally speaking, and with the model you've described where the treasurer simply invested in the market, broadly speaking, it does have no benefit to Oregon any more than it would to New York State over that period. Now, you could, I'm not necessarily suggesting that, but you could structure it where the investment was to go within Oregon. You could set up a fund that said the fund money over the period it's being held is to be a lending fund for rural communities in the state, for example. So there are things that you could do on that line. I'm just giving these off the top of my head. That they would need some thought on it, but that could work. And then tying that into the education argument, one of the things I was speaking with somebody this morning on education is in the rural parts of the state, if any of you are from the smaller areas, education is typically the number one employer in rural and smaller counties.
True here.
Not only is it the number one employer, I just worked with Tennessee on this. On their six poorest counties, the school board employed one out of every three college graduates in the county.
Wow.
If they weren't there, those are the main earners in the state. You're both very directly, from a budgetary standpoint, supporting those counties, and then the education itself is creating potential entrepreneurs that can stay in the community, that can work there, and that can actually create jobs in the small areas. So that's just an incidental tie-in.
You know, it occurs to me as we've been talking that one of the things that both of you have been encouraging us to do, and I want to just say it and see if you agree with it, is that we should stick to the things that we actually have some influence and control over and not sweat too much the ones that we don't. Decisions made by entrepreneurs, by large businesses and small, will be the decisions they make based on their considerations. The decisions we ought to make are the ones that we actually have control over, like education spending, what we put into transportation and roads, how efficient the state government is, what our budgetary, what our business practice streamlining is, and those kinds of things. And make decisions on tax matters based on raising the revenue we need in order to fund those other programs, with due regard for the issues that you two have raised.
You have pretty well summarized what the major bond rating firms, when they rank states and look at them in terms of creditworthiness, pretty much say in long detail what you just said in summary, that a well-managed state is one that has, let's say, a rainy day fund, some contingency plan, has good management structure for how to handle funds over time in case of downturns, that doesn't engage in more risky activity that might cause its revenue to fluctuate more often than not. You'd get a better bond rating if you had a rainy day fund. It would save you money. I'm not sure what your total indebtedness is right now, but you're probably paying a fairly good chunk of interest to somebody.
We certainly are.
Your rate would fall that you have to pay if you had a rainy day fund.
Yeah.
And they look at just the things you're describing. They trust states to be, you can be expected to be pretty good at managing state budgets. You're not expected to be really good at managing firms and understanding how they link in with you. So they kind of look at you to be good general managers of the state, but not to engage in things that they consider to be risky. So I think you're exactly on the money on that.
Thank you.
I think we heard that, Mr. Chair, at the Economic Summit last year with Dr. Porter, I believe, Michael Porter. He said you've got some economic clusters here. You concentrate on what you do the very, very best.
Mm-hmm.
You make decisions around what you're capable of doing. My wife and I have done that in our marriage. She makes all the small decisions. I make all the large ones. I decide whether we stay in the UN, who ought to be president. She decides where we live, where I work.
That's great.
That's a smart man.
On that note, thank you, gentlemen, very much enlightening presentation. The House Revenue Committee will stand in recess until 1 o'clock for a different presentation.
Thank you. You've elevated our debate. We will meet at 8:45 Monday for senators who are listening. 8:45, so we'll have to get word out for the senators, and we are adjourned.